Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. As of 2005, more than 340 individuals across the country were found to have been wrongfully convicted of a serious crime. Many of these people were facing long prison terms. Some of them were awaiting execution. This morning in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about how and why wrongful convictions occur, and how one state has tried to separate the innocent from the guilty. And our guest is John Gould. He is associate professor in the Department of Administration of Justice at George Mason University, where he also teaches in the School of Law. He's a former U.S. Supreme Court fellow and also is chair of the Innocence Commission for Virginia. This is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization helping prevent wrongful convictions in the state of Virginia. And it is, in fact, the second Innocence Commission in the country. We'll talk this morning a little bit about the history of the Innocence Commission there in the state of Virginia and this movement to take a look at the possibility, at least, that there are many people in the country who have been convicted of crimes that they did not commit. He's authored a book, a subject. It's titled The Innocence Commission, the subtitle Preventing Wrongful Convictions and Restoring the Criminal Justice System. His book is published by the New York University Press. Questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The number is 333-9455. That's the number to use if you are listening here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one would be good anywhere that you could hear us, around Illinois and Indiana if you're listening over the air or on the Internet in the United States, and that's 800-222-9455. Either way, you certainly are welcome to join in the conversation. All we ask of callers is that they are brief so that we can keep things moving along and get in as many as possible. But again, anybody's welcome. Locally, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Professor Gould, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure in being there.
The number that I use there, that's pulled out of the book. To date, do you have a number? How many people have been exonerated across the country?
Well, the number keeps rising. We're into the 300s at this point. And I think the word exoneration here, we need to make sure that we're clear on how that's being used. Mm-hmm. These are cases where there is clear evidence that the person who was convicted of a serious crime, and these are serious crimes, these are rapes and murders, these are not generally other crimes that we're talking about, have been proven not to be the person who committed the crime. Mm-hmm. As DNA technology and other methods have arisen, we're seeing this number continue to go up.
And how many of these people had been facing execution?
A good chunk of them, probably about half or so of them, had been either on death row or had been subject to the death penalty at some point.
I think that it's interesting you pose this question at the opening of the first chapter, talking about the fact that if 20 years ago you made the claim that innocent people had been wrongfully convicted of serious crimes, most people would say, well, that's absurd, that's silly, that can't possibly be. And yet, in 2001, a Harris poll found that 94% of Americans believed that innocent defendants are sometimes executed. That's an enormous change over a relatively short period of time in the public mind. Why do you think that change occurred?
Because of DNA technology. I think before, people tended to think that when someone was convicted, they clearly had done it, they were to be put away, and that any of their claims that they were innocent should just be sloughed off. And then what we've seen, though, is with DNA technology, we've been able to show that many of these people did not do the crime. And as there have been more and more press accounts of people walking out of prison innocent, and also as there have been more prosecutors and police officers and politicians of good conscience who have said, look, these people are not the folks who did the crime. We need to let them out. It has been harder and harder for people to cling to the notion that the criminal justice system is always accurate. Now, to be sure, it's much, much more accurate than it's not. It's accurate the vast, vast majority of times. But it has been this group of cases where someone has been wrongly convicted, and we now have hard evidence of it that has convinced people that we need to take a closer look at these cases to understand what's led to the wrongful conviction, and then most importantly, we need to put in measures to prevent these kinds of errors from happening in the future.
Yeah. It seems that here you've touched on what in a lot of people's minds would be an important question, and that is, if you look at the numbers of individuals who are charged with serious crimes and found guilty, and compare that with the, so to date, the number of people who have been exonerated, that is, who were charged, found guilty of a serious crime, and then it was proven that this individual was not the person who committed that crime. That number, even if it's in the 300s, it's a small fraction of the number of convictions. So one would ask the question, well, just how big a problem do we have
right,
here?
Why spend all this time and effort on these cases?
Indeed.
And I think the answer is twofold. Number one, we do have this notion in America that we are only supposed to be convicting the guilty, and to not only convict, but to potentially subject people to the death penalty who are not guilty goes very much against all of American notions of fairness and liberty and justice. That's number one. Number two is, if you look at the percentage of cases where someone was on death row or someone was convicted of murder, the numbers of those is against the numbers of people who've been found to be innocent. Even if you use a really, really conservative figure of, say, maybe 0.5% of folks who were convicted of a serious crime are innocent, that still leads you to tens of thousands of people across the country who are in prison for crimes they did not commit. And these are for cases where we put the most number of resources on the prosecutions, where there is a capital charge, or even if it's not a capital charge, where there's a murder, we tend to see the greatest amount of police and prosecutorial resources put onto a case. If we're seeing tens of thousands of those cases where someone potentially is innocent, the numbers are much larger across the country. And that then becomes very costly for us as taxpayers, and it also means that the real perpetrators are out there. And so if what we're trying to do is make our neighborhood safer, and if we're trying to save tax dollars for all of us, then we really do need to be paying attention to these cases.
Mm. These exonerations that we've talked about seem to be the result in large part of the efforts of small groups of individuals in a number of places, attorneys and investigators, and in some cases students, journalism students, law students, their teachers, all of these people putting their efforts together without pay to investigate these cases. What was it that got this rolling and got it from being something that was relatively a small-scale phenomena to something that now amounts to something of a movement?
I think it was that people had been interested in these cases for years. And when there was then new technology to be able to prove definitively whether someone's DNA was part of a crime scene, it was just the kind of opportunity that lots and lots of people wanted to become a part of. Because now there really was a chance to say definitively whether someone truly did commit the crime or not. And it became kind of a snowball. People, in fact, in the state of Illinois, that's where a lot of this started. Professor David Protas up at Northwestern University, and then reporters at the Chicago Tribune got involved in these. We have the Innocence Project out of New York with Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld. It has just kind of snowballed, and we've seen now lots and lots of folks from law enforcement do post-conviction investigations because they had some questions. We had a case here in Virginia where the true perpetrator was finally caught and the innocent person was let out of jail because of a single detective in the county of Arlington who was convinced that the person behind bars was not the correct person. He started his own investigation, got the FBI involved, and lo and behold, he was correct.
Just for a moment, and then I promise I have a caller here I'll get right to. Tell us about the history, something of the history of the Innocence Commission for Virginia.
The Innocence Commission for Virginia started from basically five people sitting in a room one day saying, you know, we all have been involved in some way in post-conviction cases, and we were kind of tired of all talking with one another about it, and we decided that it was time that we all got together and did something to see if we could move the ball forward. And so what we were able to do was to recruit a number of, well, we recruited three nonprofit organizations, and from that we then recruited 11 national law firms who gave us about $500,000 of free legal time to investigate these cases. We were able to also create an advisory board, and we had probably 30 or more investigators looking at these cases. There were 11 cases in Virginia since 1980 where there was no question that someone had been exonerated of a rape or murder. And what we wanted to know about was what had led to the wrongful conviction in the first place and what could be done to prevent these in the future. And so really it's the power of a group of people sitting around and deciding it was time to move forward.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is John Gould. He is the chair of the Innocence Commission for Virginia. He also teaches law at George Mason University. He is the author of the book, The Innocence Commission, Preventing Wrongful Convictions and Restoring the Criminal Justice System, published by the New York University Press. We do have a caller here, someone who is listening to us this morning in Chicago, and we will talk with them on our line number four. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Before I start, let me just say that I do favor the death penalty. I think if you take a life, you should be willing to forfeit your own. You may not be willing to, but you should be compelled to. And I think that the fact that we have all this advanced technology is a pretty good excuse that we should keep the death penalty. Not all of us here in Illinois are fond of what George Ryan did. We think it was disgraceful. We think that he lied to the families of the victims. He said he wasn't going to commute everybody. And then he went to Northwestern, a very liberal university, and basically turned two-faced and did it. Now he finds himself in prison. What does that say for him? All I'm saying is that if you go into the jails or the prisons, 99.9% of the people you talk to will say, I didn't do it. I'm here because I'm not supposed to be here. I don't belong here. You'll hear that every time. And I've heard this argument for the last, 40, 50 years, since the 1960s, where we should take extra steps to protect prisoners and we should do all of these things. And yet, I'm not saying that all of these people are guilty, but I'm saying they're more guilty than they are innocent. And I'd like to get your comment.
Well, I don't disagree with some of what the caller said. In fact, I think I said earlier that the vast majority of people who are convicted under our criminal justice system are, in fact, guilty. The fact that, though, there are a not inconsequential number of people who are innocent means that we cannot slough this off as something that, oh, well, that's just a few eggs you got to break to make an omelet, particularly when, as the caller says, we are talking about the death penalty. One thing I should add is that the Innocence Commission for Virginia has taken and will continue to take no position on the death penalty. In fact, one of the beauties of an organization like ours is that we were able to bring together people from a vast number of ideological perspectives, because it is very difficult, in fact, it's anathema, I would argue, to say that someone who is innocent should be convicted and potentially subject to death. And so many people who are in favor of the death penalty have recognized that the work of groups like the Innocence Project and the Innocence Commission for Virginia are essential if what we're after here is justice.
Well, I can go along with that, but I would like to know your opinion about this. I have seen defense attorneys who are angry because they didn't get their way, as far as the death penalty is concerned, deliberately try and bankrupt the legal system. Now, how about this? One, you compel every suspect to take a DNA, get a DNA sample, and two, you put a cap on the amount of money that a defense attorney can charge. He shouldn't be allowed to charge $500 an hour so that he can get his way or so that he can bankrupt the system.
Well, two responses to that. Number one, in most states around the country, when a suspect is arrested on a felony, they're required to give a DNA sample at this point. So that's actually being accomplished in most states. Second of all, I cannot think of a state in the country that allows appointed attorneys to get $500 an hour. Maybe they are getting it from richer defendants, but in many states, including my own in Virginia, the amount of money that defense attorneys can charge and that the courts will pay is capped at a very, very low level. In fact, in a number of murder cases in Virginia, for example, counsel is capped at about 13 hours of work. And I would ask listeners whether if they were charged with a murder and they were looking at life in prison, whether they would be comfortable with their defense counsel being able to spend only 13 hours of time. This includes meeting them for the first time, going to trial, preparing for trial, and that to me doesn't strike doesn't sound like justice. Now,
he could do a pro bono, couldn't he?
Why would we expect attorneys to give away time when we don't expect any other profession to do it on a regular basis? Now, what I would say in response to your larger point, which if I'm hearing you correctly, I think you're concerned about what you see as a criminal justice system that is giving too many, I think you would probably say, rights to the defendants, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. So I think this is a position on which reasonable people can disagree. That's not what the subject of my book is. That's not what the subject of the Innocence Commission is about. What I'm concerned about here, and what I think many people are concerned about, is the fact that we do have this, we're in the 21st century, we talk about being one of the most modern countries in the world, and yet when it comes to investigating cases and trying to identify who in fact is the perpetrator or not, we're not using the best technology and the best methods so that we can separate out the guilty from the innocent. I think we all agree, or at least I would say I agree with you, that if someone is guilty, they should be prosecuted and they should be in prison. That's why we have a criminal justice system. What I am most concerned about, and what I hope you would agree with, is that we should be separating out those who are truly innocent.
Well, I hope we can do that. Like I said, with advanced technology like DNA, I think you're going to see less of this, these innocent people being convicted. But let me point out also, and I agree with a lot of what you say, but let me point out, just because these guys didn't commit this crime, that doesn't mean they're innocent of other crimes.
That's possible, but you know, we don't in this country just throw people in prison because we think they may have done something.
The whole
notion here is that we need to be able to prove that someone did do what he's charged with. Otherwise, you know, the alternative is what we saw in the Soviet Union for years. But back to the point you just made, I think you're correct that as we see better technology used at the front end of cases, we may very well see the number of wrongful convictions go down. And I think that would be a good thing that we would all like to see.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest again is John Gould. He is a professor at George Mason University, where he teaches in the School of Law. He's also the chair of the Innocence Commission for Virginia. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to prevent wrongful convictions in the state of Virginia. And he's authored a book about the activities of the Innocence Commission, this one specifically, but also in a larger sense, the issue of wrongful convictions. And his book is The Innocence Commission, and it's published by New York University Press. What you do in the book is you take a look at a representative sample of cases and then ask the question, what were the factors that contributed to the wrongful conviction? And since the last caller raised some issues about attorneys, to what extent is the quality of representation or the lack of the quality of representation an issue in wrongful convictions?
It is certainly one of the factors. Of the many factors that are involved, I would probably put it third behind eyewitness identification problems and problems with interrogations. So I think that we find that, what we did find when we looked at the cases in Virginia is that inadequate representation was definitely a part of it. It was either, in some cases, attorneys who had very, very little experience and had no business handling cases like this, or attorneys who didn't have the time or put the energy in to fully investigate cases. And so you had, for example, someone like Earl Washington, a man with an IQ in the 70s, or actually a little bit lower than 70, come within 9 days of being executed because his attorney didn't recognize what evidence there was in the case, didn't investigate it, and didn't object to its introduction. Only when he was able to get pro bono representation, and this was a situation of Earl Washington was sitting on death row 9 days before he was to be executed. One of his fellow death row mates put him in touch with this other guy's lawyer, a large New York law firm, and they decided to look into his case, found that, oh my goodness, there was evidence in this case that strongly suggested that he was innocent, and decided to go to the judge and assist Earl Washington pro bono very close to his execution date. I should add that when this thing finally got resolved many, many years later, and this would have been about 2 years ago that it finally, actually it was last year that it got resolved, Earl Washington won the largest civil judgment in the history of the Commonwealth of Virginia against the police department that handled his case. So this was a situation where if the defense attorney had simply done the job that we expect every defense attorney to do at the front end of the case, we would have all been spared what came after it. But it was, in many ways, a situation of an inexperienced counsel and one that was not being compensated by the people of the Commonwealth of Virginia adequately to be able to do the kind of work we would expect. Mm-hmm.
This is the, one of the things that I know has been part of the discussion here in Illinois about the death penalty, and I'm sure elsewhere. And I think that here the consensus was of the number of the panels that looked at it was that one of the things that must be is that attorneys defending an individual who faces the possibility of execution have to be experienced in defending those kinds of cases. We must expect that they have the experience and the training to do that. And I'm sure that there are other places around the country where they have at least said the same thing. Is there a movement toward that?
There is. And the ABA, the American Bar Association, now has guidelines speaking very much to that issue. And many, many states have now made a requirement or established a requirement that counsel need to be what's called death qualified to be able to handle these cases. So I think we've actually made a lot of progress on capital cases in ensuring that the defendants who are facing the death penalty have counsel who have experience in these kinds of matters and know the law and know how to kind of how to litigate these kinds of cases. I think actually the larger problem, and one that is still looming out there in most states, is the quality and the time that people are compensated for, this would be attorneys, in the non-capital cases. And in many ways an understandable sentiment. Taxpayers don't want to spend money for defense counsel who are going to represent defendants who get convicted a large percentage of the time. At the same time, if we don't provide adequate representation for people who are going to be convicted potentially of murder or rape or some other matter, first of all, we leave ourselves open to the real possibility that some of these people will be wrongly convicted and the real perpetrator will be out there. And second of all, we're not meeting what our standards are of the United States. If we are simply saying, well, look, you know, give them some very minor representation and they'll get convicted anyhow, that's not what a democratic republic is supposed to be. What you're talking about then is a totalitarian regime. You might as well move somewhere else if that's what we're satisfied with as a criminal justice system.
We have another caller. This is someone listening in Terre Haute, Indiana, on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, first, I just want to say I was once a very strong proponent for the death penalty, but after I got more involved with the legal system on my own through my youth, I learned that sometimes police get tunnel vision, and they're so sure they have the right person, even though they don't, that I slowly got away from that, and now I'm quite opposed to it, because just putting one person to death wrongly just doesn't feel right, and that my main point is that I also watch a lot of these shows. You know, I watch these shows and I see the policemen. They seem to get tunnel vision. You know, they think they have the right person, and sometimes they even ignore evidence that they have in front of them to the contrary. And I'd like maybe you to talk about that. Have you noticed any of that in some of the stuff you've reviewed?
Absolutely. Tunnel vision is one of the factors that's behind most of the wrongful convictions around the country. Now, I should add a couple things. Number one, at least in the cases we've investigated, and frankly in many of the cases that I've seen nationwide, these are not cases where police officers are acting in some malevolent manner to convict someone they know to be innocent. There are a few of these cases.
I don't, I'm not saying that they
no,
are.
I'm not suggesting you're saying that.
They feel such pressure from above to solve the case that once they get what they think is the right person in front of them, they just quit looking.
Well, and I think in many ways that's a natural human reaction. Think about it for a moment. Most of these cases, if we're talking about rape and murder, and especially if we're talking about capital cases, are horrible, notorious cases that are in the press daily. They're on our nightly news. They are sometimes on, say, CNN or Fox Television. You're seeing these over and over and over again. And the natural reaction is to want to solve these and solve them quickly. We all want to believe that the perpetrator is going to be off the streets as quickly as possible to protect us, and that that person will be convicted. So I think it is a natural human instinct to want to find the answer as quickly as possible. And so if you're in that situation, if you have some initial evidence that seems to point to a particular person, there is unfortunately a tendency at times to ignore evidence that doesn't comport with that theory. This is known as tunnel vision, as the caller is suggesting. And we've seen this time and time again in the wrongful convictions. But we see this time and time again in many parts of human existence where we kind of start to think that this is the way things are going, and we are blind to facts that don't jive with our understanding of what's going on.
All right. We're just a little bit past the midpoint here, and what I would like to do is to introduce again, for benefit of anybody who's just tuned in, introduce again our guest, John Gould. He is Associate Professor in the Department of Administration of Justice at George Mason University, where he also teaches in the School of Law. He's a former U.S. Supreme Court Fellow. He is the chair of the Innocence Commission for Virginia. That is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that is working to prevent wrongful convictions in Virginia. He's authored a book that looks at, in part, about the history of the Virginia Innocence Commission, but also of this more general movement to look at wrongful convictions. His book is titled The Innocence Commission, Preventing Wrongful Convictions and Restoring the Criminal Justice System. That's the subtitle. The book is published by the New York University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the issue of representation, the adequacy of representation, and I asked you about how significant that was, and you said that you would perhaps list that as the third most significant behind two other things, and I want to talk about those other things. The first one is eyewitness identification. There are a lot of cases that hinge on that, on people saying, I saw this individual do this, this person attacked me, this person did that. And at the same time, I think now there's a growing body of evidence that's been conducted by psychologists that actually eyewitness identification is notoriously unreliable. We think we see things, but that may not be the way that things really were. What's the problem with eyewitness identification, and what do you do with that? How do you fold that in and yet deal with its shortcomings?
Well, the problem with it is it's incredibly persuasive evidence in court. And so jurors have a tendency to believe the eyewitness, even though, as you were suggesting, the research shows that eyewitness identification is not always that reliable. So imagine for a moment you're a juror and you're sitting in court and the victim is on the stand. And the question goes to the victim, do you recognize the perpetrator in court today? And the victim points to the defendant sitting at the defense table and says, that's him, that's the perpetrator. I would never forget that face ever. That's incredibly persuasive evidence. And jurors want to believe that the victim remembers it. And in fact, if you were to ask most people, if someone is in a criminal situation, if someone's a victim and they're witnessing a crime and they see right then the picture of the perpetrator in their mind, are they getting it accurate? And most people, most jurors, most folks on the street would say, yeah, because it's such a noteworthy event, you're going to remember who that person is. And yet, all the research on eyewitness identification suggests that being in such a stressful situation is going to alter your memory and your perception so that you'll actually get it wrong too often. There is a wonderful website that's run by Professor Gary Wells at Iowa State University, and if you just Google him and go on, his website, there is an opportunity to take part in a little test of your own ability to do eyewitness identification, and it's shocking how often we're wrong. So if we have this kind of evidence that is both persuasive to jurors and yet inaccurate too often, the question has to be asked, what do you do about it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are a couple things that can be done. First of all, eyewitness identification procedures at police departments are in many areas now being changed so that people are observing potential suspects one at a time rather than all of them there at the same time. They're not being given feedback by police officers of, oh, good, that's a great answer, or take a look again at suspect number two. You know, doesn't he look a little bit like the person? So that we're not having suggestive identification procedures. Another thing that states are doing is they're allowing experts to come in and testify for jurors who may not recognize it, just how what the weaknesses are in eyewitness identification, so that jurors may look at this evidence with the grain of salt that I think it deserves. This isn't to suggest that eyewitnesses are wrong the majority of time. It is to say, though, that there are some serious problems with many of the identifications, and jurors need to be aware of that.
Well, if you take a look at, you know, to the extent that you're familiar with, and we're talking about hundreds of cases, if you take a look at a representative slice of the exonerations across the country, has this been a factor in many convictions where an individual says, absolutely no doubt about it, this person in front of me, John Doe, this is the person that I saw commit the crime, and that it turns out, though, that you can establish by other kinds of evidence that, in fact, this person, John Doe, did not commit the crime?
Yeah, it's on a sliding scale. I'd say the plurality of the cases where eyewitness identifications become an issue are not where the person says, I'm absolutely positive. It's more where someone thinks they may be right, they go through a couple lineups, and they become more and more fixed on the fact that they identified this particular suspect. There are, though, several cases. We have many of them in Virginia where they're often rape cases, where the victim identifies someone and says, I know that's the person. And then, as we've seen here in Virginia, the DNA comes back showing that it wasn't that person. It couldn't have been that person. This also becomes a problem in cross-racial identification. So where, for example, the victim is of one race and the perpetrator is another, research shows that people as a whole are much better at doing identifications of folks who look like them than people who look differently from them. So we've seen that in Virginia where there are cross-racial identification problems in rape cases.
The other thing that you mentioned, in addition to the issue of quality of representation in this business of eyewitness identification, has to do with interrogations. And certainly we have seen a number of cases where there have been allegations, some of them proven allegations, that coercion of various kinds, right up to something that you might well be able to consider torture, a coercion of individuals, getting people to confess or getting people to say things that then contributed to their conviction.
Right. And we've seen that in a number of different kinds of cases. We've seen very few where there is physical coercion or something of that kind that would get someone to confess to a crime that he didn't commit. More often what we see are cases where someone is interrogated for 36 hours or so, and the person just gets worn down and ends up either confessing or giving some facts that don't match what he did but are consistent with what the perpetrator did and thus become part of the case against him. The third kind of cases we see are ones where interrogation techniques, which are very, very, very effective, by the way, but interrogation techniques are used against people either with mental deficiencies or with juveniles, and they are much easier to get to confess. We've seen that in two cases in Virginia where interrogations got people to confess who had low IQs and could not possibly have committed the crimes. In fact, in the book, I have the transcript from one of these interrogations with a defendant by the name of David Vasquez, another person with a very, very low IQ, where he's essentially fed the lines that he then says, oh, yes, okay, yeah, I did it that way. And he didn't do it that way. I think the way to solve this problem, or one of the ways to solve this problem, and frankly, it's a way that will actually help lead to greater convictions of people who did the crimes, is to videotape interrogations. Mm-hmm. Because what it does is it gives jurors and judges an opportunity to see what happened inside the interrogation room, to see whether there was any sort of improper or undue influence. So you have a full picture of the interrogation rather than simply the signed statement from the defendant. Police departments that have used this have found that it's incredibly effective in getting people to plead guilty for crimes they did do. Because as a defendant, you can't walk away from your statement that you did it, because it's there on videotape. And if there's no sign that anything improper was done in your interrogation, if you said you did it, then you really can't try to argue that, oh, well, something improper happened later. And so people who are shown their videotapes later more often plead, and there has been a huge drop in cases against police officers for improper conduct in those departments. So this is a win-win sort of technology. It's about $3,000 a camera for most police departments or less these days. This is the kind of thing where if you want to spend your tax dollars in a way that will prevent wrongful convictions and lead to faster cases for people who did do the crime, this is where you ought to put your money.
All right. Let's talk with someone here in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Fascinating subject, especially for people in this part of Illinois where just last week we saw that a man convicted of murder wrongfully was let out of prison after 20 years. But regarding your project, do you get resistance to the Innocence Project from judges and prosecutors who, for political reasons or their own personal pride, don't want to be made to look bad?
Definitely want to answer your question. Let me distinguish two things. There's the Innocence Project, and then there's the Innocence Commission for Virginia.
Okay.
The Innocence Project provides attorneys and investigators for people who are in prison who are claiming that they are innocent. And the Innocence Project either assists them or says they cannot, but when they assist them, they assist them to try to prove that, in fact, they are innocent. The Innocence Commission for Virginia took cases where someone had already been exonerated and tried to understand what happened. So I can speak from our experience. Our experience is, the answer to your question is yes, that there are police officers who are resistant either because they think they were right at first, or they don't want to be made to look bad, or there are prosecutors. There is a prosecutor in Oregon, for example, who thinks that it's a big waste of time and money to be focusing on these cases because the majority of cases are accurate. And I agree with him. The majority of cases, they are accurate. Where we disagree is what it means to have someone wrongfully convicted, both in terms of what it says for our justice system, but also what it says to us as people who want to be made safe and who want to keep our taxes lower. So we've been fortunate that there have been a number of prosecutors and judges, too, not only in Virginia but around the country, who've said, look, none of us has an interest in having someone behind bars or worse who's innocent of the crime, and we all have an interest in figuring out what went wrong. If you think about it, when a plane crashes or a train has an accident, the National Transportation Safety Board sends investigators to figure out what happened and to prevent it from happening in the future. At many hospitals, when someone dies, the doctors get together in what's called an M&M conference to try to understand what happened to prevent these things in the future. Only in the criminal justice system, when we have a gross error, do we kind of throw up our hands and say, well, we don't want to learn more about it.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you again. We have, again, about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Once again, our guest for the show is John Gould. He teaches law at George Mason University. He is also chair of the Innocence Commission for Virginia, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that looks at trying to prevent wrongful convictions in the state of Virginia. And he's also authored a book about the commission and about this issue generally. His book is titled The Innocence Commission, and it is published by the New York University Press. One of the basic rights that people have, and I'm sure that people at least know that from watching television, is that if you're taken in for questioning by the police, you don't have to say anything without having an attorney present. Is there some way, or do you think that somehow people don't understand that, or they aren't adequately involved, advised of their rights, so that we could get around to some of these problems that you've talked about having to do with interrogations if people were willing to stick by that and say, look, I'm not going to say anything until I have an attorney here sitting next to me?
Probably not as much as people would like to think. First of all, that would only really help defendants who are innocent in questioning by police officers. There are a whole host of other factors that help to explain wrongful convictions. But even in terms of interrogations, I think, first of all, you are correct that most people are not aware that if police start questioning you and you simply state, I do not want to say anything until my attorney is present, questioning must stop at that point and cannot start again unless you ask for it to start again. And I think many people don't know that. But apart from that, officers are very good at interrogation. This is what we want police officers to do. We want them to be able to interrogate the guilty in a way that gets them to give up facts, because there are many cases that couldn't be closed otherwise. So I don't think the issue here is trying to get people not to talk. What we're interested in is making sure that the playing field is fair and that what's being said is accurate. And so that's where I think that videotaping of interrogations is much more the way to go.
One of the issues that has come up in many of these cases is the use of testimony for the prosecution by witnesses who are questionable, and particularly people who are currently serving time in jail, have been convicted of some kind of crime. And you would think that the accuracy of their information would at least be questionable, and you'd also have to question their motives for being willing to testify in a particular case. To what extent is that a kind of issue a problem or something that you have seen contributing to a wrongful conviction?
That's a good question. This is known as snitch testimony, mm-hmm. where someone who's in custody with the defendant claims that the defendant told him that, yes, I did it, and here's how I did it, et cetera, et cetera. Surprisingly, we didn't see this in any of the Virginia cases, but in Illinois, your so-called Ryan Commission, the one that looked at the cases of people being wrongly convicted in Illinois, did find this to be a substantial problem. There are a number of possible solutions for that. One is testimony about the snitch and his character, what he has to gain from the testimony. Other possibilities that I've seen recommended is that snitch testimony not be allowed without some sort of corroborating evidence, because you have to remember that oftentimes these people who are coming forward to testify about what the defendant said or did not say are themselves criminals. Have a lot to gain by fabricating evidence. I'm not saying that the prosecutors or police officers are asking for that. Rather, I'm saying that this is a situation where there's someone here with a motive that needs to be more fully explored, and his veracity needs to be better tested if we're even going to allow his evidence into court in the first place.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Effingham. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Downstate Illinois, just recently near the Champaign-Urbana area, a young man took 5 revolvers or handguns to school with the intent to sell them, was caught and put in jail, and he's only 16 years old, and he stands to get 3 years in prison. Well, he'll be the ripe old age of 19 if that happens, and what will he have learned inside the jail, and what sort of citizen he's going to be? It all starts somewhere. Capital, no matter if it's petty or capital crimes, they all start somewhere. Thank you.
All right. You can comment on any way you like.
Well, I think what the sentiment there is the one that is reflective of a larger sentiment that makes it difficult at times to examine the wrongful conviction cases and take action. Because we tend to think that, well, if what we're trying to do here is to figure out who's innocent, then we must clearly be against law enforcement and that we're pro-criminal. That's actually just the opposite. The one of the purposes for examining wrongful convictions is to make sure that the correct criminal is being prosecuted, because we don't want these people on our streets. I think we can agree on that. The guilty should be punished. But by the same token, we should not be having the innocent behind bars or executed, because it says so many things about our system that we don't want to say. It creates greater crime because the true perpetrator is on the street, and it costs us more in terms of tax dollars. So what I would encourage people to do is, if they truly are interested in reducing crime and reducing tax dollars, then we need to put some sort of pressure on officials in the criminal justice system and politicians to look at the cases where something went wrong. And if something has gone wrong, we want to prevent that from happening in the future. So this is not in any way so-called pro-criminal or in some way against law and order. Indeed, if you are in favor of law and order, you should be in favor of trying to perfect and correct any problems that exist in the criminal justice system.
We're coming to the point here where we have two, 3 minutes left. Are there many other states that have innocence commissions, something that is similar to that that's there in Virginia?
There are several that are beginning to develop them. So North Carolina has the very first one. We have another. Wisconsin has had a variety of one. It hasn't been quite called this, but it's looked a little bit like this. California has one. Connecticut and New York are toying with them. So there are a number of states that are beginning to go down this road and investigate these questions. Really, every state should be taking this on themselves, whether they call it an innocence commission or whether it's simply in a police academy or in a prosecutor's training group, to look at cases where errors occurred to try to make sure they don't happen in the future. And we really all ought to be getting on board this issue, because we really do want a criminal justice system that works.
Well, assuming that that we try to move in some of these areas and yet we still come up short, and that we still have individuals who are wrongfully convicted, what you say also that we do have to give something has to be available for people in the way of an appeals process afterwards, for them to, if indeed they believe and there is some evidence that they have been wrongfully convicted, that there is some kind of mechanism to review that conviction.
Right. This is post-conviction review. We've now developed it in Virginia, giving people the opportunity to either bring in new DNA evidence or other sort of biological evidence that was not available at the time, or any other evidence that was not available at the time and shows innocence. If we can do it in Virginia, it ought to be able to be done in any state in the United States. This is not something that takes up a lot of time. You get one bite at the apple. It has to be evidence that shows innocence. It has to be something that was unavailable. If you have that, then we all should have an interest in getting that person out of prison. It is not the kind of process that adds lots and lots of time or money to the system. Mm-hmm.
Trying a capital case can be extremely expensive, and certainly it can get to be very expensive if you're bringing in experts to give forensic testimony, if you have to pay for that kind of testing. I think one of the things that has been suggested, at least here in the state of Illinois, is that a fund be created so that both prosecutors and defense attorneys can have some resources to draw on to do that very thing, to pay for testing to be done, to pay to hire expert witnesses. Is that an issue, and is that something that you think it would be a good idea for there to be actually public money available, and you would have to say it should be available both to the defense and the prosecution to make sure that they have the resources to adequately try the case?
Well, there is money available right now for the prosecution and for the defense for these things. It all goes through the court. So you have to get court permission, if you're the defense counsel, to get the money to do these kinds of cases. Prosecutors usually have it built into their budget. I think the proposal you're talking about is a fund that would provide money to counsel to do this without having to go to court. That is certainly one solution. New Jersey has just taken another approach, which is they've said, you know, capital cases are so expensive, they are really draining lots and lots of money. We can basically get the same result we want, which is dangerous people off the street, by going to life in prison without parole. And actually, New Jersey's gotten rid of its death penalty. Whether that's a good idea, I leave to other people, but I would say that it is likely in the long run to cost the state of New Jersey a lot less money.
Well, at this point, I think we're going to have to finish up. Again, if you're interested in reading more on this issue, the book is The Innocence Commission, the subtitle Preventing Wrongful Convictions and Restoring the Criminal Justice System, by our guest John Gould. He is associate professor in the Department of Administration of Justice at George Mason University, where he also teaches in the School of Law. He is, in addition, the chair of the Innocence Commission for Virginia. Professor Gould, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.